Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Earned First podcast. This is Arun Sudharman, and I'm very happy to be joined today by someone who I've known for many years. He's the CEO of Burson South Asia Pacific, Mr. Adrian Waugh. Welcome, Adrian.
Thank you very much for having me, Arun. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And where are you today?
I am in my home office today in Thailand.
Very nice. Okay, maybe we'll talk about Thailand a little bit later on. But first of all, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm aware that you are busy. It seems like it's a busy time at Burson always. A lot has happened. So you've been at Burson now for how long?
It's been 10 months now. So I'm approaching my first year there, and it's it still feels fresh and exciting and new. But it's coming up to a year.
Wow, all right. And let's just recap your career to date. So before Burson, you did 10 years at Edelman?
Yeah. Okay. I was with Edelman 10 years. Well, let me go right back. Let's go chronologically, otherwise I'll get lost. My first job was in market research, really, called competitive intelligence, but I think that was just a nice rebranding of market research. And I did that in the US. I was doing a firm between New York and Philadelphia for a while. But then decided, I really wanted to find the right kind of job in the communications industry. So I came back to London and joined Hill & Knowlton and did 7 years with Hill & Knowlton in London, which I absolutely loved. Had a fantastic time working their corporate and financial team. Brilliant clients, brilliant team, fantastic office. Absolutely loved it. But when an opportunity came along with Freud, decided to try that because it was extremely different. So I went from big holding company agency Hill & Knowlton to Freud, which is privately held and really only operates in London, although it's got global reach. Very, very different kind of agency. Learned a whole bunch of new things there and then moved off to Portland, which is back then was before the sale, before it sold to Omnicom. And that was working in a sort of newly formed corporate comms team alongside the public affairs team there to help amplify the campaigns they were putting out. But then decided to move over to Asia and joined Edelman. And did 10 years with Edelman in a variety of roles based in Hong Kong and across South China, and then in Singapore, ultimately. Then lucky enough to come along and join Burson.
Indeed, yeah, right. A few months after the merger was announced, I think.
That's right. So last sort of September, October time, and we've just had our one-year anniversary.
Yes, indeed.
A few weeks back.
The Bursonversary.
The Bursonversary.
No one calls it that.
No, we've not started calling it a birthday yet.
Fair enough. So obviously there's a lot about Burson. We'll get to Burson in a little bit, but first of all, you've worked at the names you mentioned there, some of the best agencies in the world over the last 20 years. Freud's and Portland, two of the UK's finest, I think, in different ways. Of course, Edelman, you were there for a decade, and that also kind of overlapped with Edelman's, rise to the top of the agency tree. And now, of course, you've got the holding group experience from Hill & Knowlton and now back at Burson. But it's kind of interesting in a way because you spent a long time at Independence in terms of Freud's and Edelman. Portland, I assume, was part of Omnicom by the time you'd joined?
No, it was just before we'd signed the deal, I left.
Yeah, okay. So you did your 7 years with H&K and now back at WPP. Now, there's been a lot of commentary about holding groups. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've seen consolidation. I mean, the merger of Burson and Hill & Knowlton is a great example of that. The Omnicom and Interpublic merger is looming. We seem to be living in an era when certainly at the holding groups, agencies are coming together, big PR firms are coming together. And I'm curious to hear how you view this as someone who's worked on both sides of the fence. How do you think that networks maintain their value when brands in some cases are being collapsed or are being brought together to create, even bigger agencies?
Yeah. I love how you asked that question, by the way, because the question you often get is, you know, that sort of binary one of is it the end of the line for holding companies or that kind of thing, which I think is a really interesting question, but perhaps looks at it from a wrong angle. I think, as you said, the right question, I think, is exactly that. How do the holdcos continue to deliver value and continue to sort of capitalize on what their strengths have been? Look, I think it does come down to sort of big shifts in the nature of how all of the different types of agencies are working. And I could tell, you know, back when I was at Portland, that was a relatively small agency at the time. And God, it was hard work. I mean, it'd be amazing to do that job now in the world that we operate in, because the ability for the smaller sized agencies to compete on a different scale is now fabulous. There's no denying that. There's absolutely been a huge rise, I think, in the small to medium-sized agency field. And rightly so. You know, we come up against some brilliant agencies all the time and win and lose against them. And they are fantastic competition. I don't think that necessarily equates to the challenges that are happening in the holdco company sphere, or the opportunities, depending on how you look at it. The two are correlated, obviously, but I don't think it's a case of clients just all moving in one direction. I think there's a lot of different dynamics going on. You know, holdcos are still very, very, very big. The majority of the revenue in industry is still with the holdcos. And I think there's a lot of good reasons for that. You know, we are undoubtedly going through a challenging time for the industry. But I think that applies to the small and medium-sized companies as well. Loads of my friends that I chat to who started up their own agencies, they're finding it incredibly hard as well. And so I do think it's natural we get this question about holdcos versus smaller-sized companies because we read about it a lot. But, you know, when Publicis, WPP, Omnicom lose a client, that's front-page news. When a small agency loses a client, that's not going to be. And so there is an availability bias to what we see in the media and how that defines our view. But look, we are certainly not sitting complacently at holdcos, and we are spending a lot of time and effort in adapting and changing what we do and adapting to the changing environment. It's one of the reasons I joined Burson, that, you know, a company that's going through so much change like that is agile, change ready, and already shifting. And so there's the opportunity to change stuff, to rebuild, and to do things differently. It's very, very hard in large companies to do that. And Burson's got a brilliant opportunity to do it. And that's one of the reasons I'm there. I think the reasons why I'm bullish about the value that holdcos can offer is well, manifold. I mean, first off, talent and bench strength. You know, one of the amazing things about walking the halls at WPP is just the sheer number of incredibly smart people in different weird fields. And that's something that no small agency can ever replicate. It's a benefit of scale. And so having massive groups of people with incredibly diverse skill sets and specialisms is a huge advantage to a lot of clients, and a lot of advantage to us as professionals, because you learn a lot through osmosis. Second thing I think is the concept of networks. And I do think that's changed a lot. I don't think hub and spoke is the way anymore. But I do think that multi-market cooperation, multi-market work is still incredibly important for clients, be that for cost efficiency or for coordination, consistency, or just for convenience, frankly. But there's a lot of advantage to being able to work with one agency in multiple markets. I do think these days it's about local excellence and regional global connectivity. There's no point in having small dots on maps and all of your brain power in one place. I think you have to have the ability to have fully functional, fully operational, really capable offices at a local level that then can then connect around the region. So we, you know, in APAC don't operate with any hubs. We have virtual excellence, various different capabilities. And that's a very deliberate decision, because we've got to be focused on the local work where the clients and the team and the stakeholders and journalists are. So I think while we've had to adapt and change away from some of our older models, we are still in a great position of strength, having a lot of different offices around the region. It's absolutely an advantage. I think specialisms are increasingly critical to clients, and that's one of the reasons why SMEs have been doing so well. If you're a financial services specialist of 20 people, you are able to do extremely well because that specialism is in great demand for clients. We can do that. Yes, we're multi-specialists, but we do have brilliant specialist businesses. Look at GCI or Axicom. Those are essentially specialist agencies within the Burson Group. And then I think AI, obviously, we're going to talk a lot about AI, I'm sure, today. But I do think there's an advantage of scale in AI, right? If you want to be able to buy into and build platforms are for LLMs, then scale is important. It really is, mm-hmm. or it certainly makes it easier. So at this stage where we're taking first mover advantage, certainly for the moment, that is, I think, a benefit of being a very, very large agency. So there's really, I think, quite a lot of reasons why I remain optimistic, but certainly we can't be complacent in the whole coast. And certainly it's a challenging environment. And we feel that as much as the rest of the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's some really interesting points there that I'd like to discuss in a little bit more detail. But I think it's a really good point. First of all, you know, everyone is kind of suffering, right? We seem to be just different shades of suffering at different types of agencies at the moment. The point you made, and I think it's also worth noting, if you're going to be at a holding group agency, you want to be at the one that is, you know, essentially that has become the hero brand, right? And of course, I think within WPP, that's clearly Burson now from a PR perspective. We'll see what happens at the other holding groups, whether it happens at all, but I suspect there will be some moves in that direction. You touched upon AI, and of course, we are going to see a lot of changes to the business from AI. I think perhaps some of that has already started to happen. But one of the things I've really noticed over the last 12 to 18 months, and I think you would have noticed it too, is just how many people have left agencies, often big agencies, often people who are, you know, who maybe have 15, 20, even 25 years of experience. And those kinds of people are not necessarily finding it easy to find their next job or position or role. Certainly not a similar kind of role to perhaps the one they had before. Does that worry you at all, that we have this potential exodus of talent from the industry, and perhaps there's this at the same time this you know, this rising idea that, you know, maybe with generative AI we don't need all this talent to remain within the industry?
It's a great question. I'll answer it in two parts, because I do think there's two separate questions in there, anyway. On the departing talent, do I worry? I mean, I find it sad, obviously. You know, it's difficult watching friends and colleagues move out of agencies and look for change and find other jobs. Yes, it's difficult. I think you've got to bear in mind, it's very easy to forget, but this is largely the result of a massive economic, political, social turmoil. Right. We are in a very weird world right now. And for lots of very good reasons, clients are spending less. We see these downturns occasionally, right, after large economic crises. But this has been a sort of long, slow one. And it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And it's, I think, because of the confluence of technological, social, political, and purely economic. There's a lot of different headwinds coming together in a weird way that mean we're going through a sort of sustained period of uncertainty. It's not even really massively a recession in most markets. It's just uncertainty. That economic environment is what's slowing everyone down. Now, normally in the big picture, right, you'd have agencies that go up and down in cycles. Everyone's in a cycle. And so I just think we're noticing a lot more because the numbers are greater because we're all in that same cycle. But I think to then link that through to AI or other causes is, it's possibly true. I couldn't prove that it's not. There's certainly going to be a cause, but I do think the overarching cause here is that it's an economic downturn.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I don't think
AI contributes.
Yeah.
AI contributes. Now, here's an interesting span to your question, which is undoubtedly it's harder for some senior people, depending on your skill set, your capabilities, and your background, it might be harder to step back into a job because the natures of those jobs are changing, yes. So as that person exits, when the company is looking to hire someone else, perhaps they are looking for a different skill set. Perhaps they are looking for someone that is going to drive their A offer differently. Perhaps they're not looking for someone who's going to be out there banging on doors driving sales, and they want someone who's going to do stakeholder relations instead. So you do get shifts in what we need in our capability base. That means you're not often doing like-for-like replacements on people. Yeah. We are changing the nature of the workforce. So, yes, there's a correlation, but I don't think when we look at the people that are exiting the industry that we can link it directly just to AI. I think it's much more the economics.
No, I totally agree. I think it's more that it may impact, like you said, it may just start to impact what people are looking for. It may not be the reason why someone's left. Clearly, that's because of the, like you said, the economic issues that we're facing. Yeah. But when it comes back to, when it comes to the next job, then is it going to have an impact?
I mean, the interesting thought experiment is to imagine what would have happened right now if AI had exploded, if ChatGPT had caused this sudden acceleration, this Cambrian boom in AI during an economic upturn. It'd be really interesting to think through what would be the impact then. Undoubtedly, you'd still have conversations about AI creating efficiency, and undoubtedly you'd still have conversations about jobs. But I wonder if, in fact, the whole focus would be much more about what it can create, what it builds, adds,
rather than what it destroys.
Which, you know, in an environment in which people are worried about their jobs because of the uncertainty we were talking about before, obviously the AI conversation, even more than usual, gets linked to that particular factor. So,
yeah, if only, if only. So let's talk about Asia. We had Richard Edelman on the last episode, and he said he wants to I only bring this up not because this is about Edelman specifically, but I think this is actually about the industry in general. And he said, you know, Edelman is almost 100 million in Asia. I think it's 90 million now. He wants to double it to 200 million. I think Burson, I know you can't reveal any numbers, but I would suspect it's not massively far off all of that. And I'm sure you have similar aspirations. But also at the same time, we are seeing networks pulling back from Asia. You know, I've seen... you know, we saw Weber Shandwick remove itself essentially from a few different Asia Pacific markets. They did keep the brand there following management buyouts. It's become more acceptable, I feel, to openly question whether big networks should be investing in Asia. And I wonder how you feel about that, because you're someone who has overseen, I mean, yes, you've overseen the big markets, like Hong Kong and Singapore, but you've also overseen, for example, Thailand, Taiwan, less fashionable markets where, you know, international agencies aren't especially active. So how do you see it? Is it as simple as being in every market? Is it as simple as not being in every market?
So good question. Very, very good question. So first off, I have very big, bold ambitions for Asia Pacific. I wouldn't necessarily characterize them in terms of scale of revenues, revenue growth. I would look at it more in terms of a goal of what we're doing globally, which is redefining modern communications. You know, it's resetting how reputation is both measured, predicted, and then delivered upon for business to drive better value. So I think we're focused on that vision. And if we get that right, then money comes with it. But I think, you know, that's in some ways semantics. I would agree with Richard that there is a massive, massive opportunity over here. I can't speak for the other holdcos or companies and their point of view. I would say for every example, there's a counterexample. You know, it was interesting, you're reporting the other day on Rudafin acquiring ARA. I think brilliant acquisition, two brilliant businesses, and very significant indication of an agency focusing on a massive Southeast Asia opportunity. And as a couple of the quotes in there said, you know, it was interesting Cambodia and Laos and some of the other markets that perhaps other people hadn't been looking at that drove some of the decision making there. Now, I think I certainly wouldn't say that you need to have a dot on the map everywhere in order to be able to succeed. I don't believe that. I don't think that that's a requirement. I love working with our affiliates where we want to work with affiliates. But I do believe that having a big network and expanding our capabilities across new markets is important because of the role they're going to play in the future. Right? I mean, let's start with India, right? I mean, it is on a fee level considerably lower than a lot of other markets and therefore not categorized in the same way. But I would say it is, you know, it is already becoming the world's next superpower. Its geopolitical significance, its economic significance, and its talent base is absolutely phenomenal. If you're not investing in growing there, then, well, good luck trying to get in 10 years. You know, and factors of local firms are incredibly good competition. And so I think, you know, being established in markets like that is incredibly important for the future. We've already got 60% of the world's population on this side of the planet. You know, India and China both have more millennials than Europe and America have to entire population. the demographics and the stat. I mean, you have a million of these stats, I'm sure. There's a new one every week. But there is no doubting the scale of growth on this side of the world versus the rest and the massive transition that we're going to have. And so the opportunity is there. Now, how long can agencies wait for that opportunity to realize? How much effort has to go into the competition to exist there? How much margin do you get versus just operating in your established markets? All of those are perfectly good questions. My point of view and Burson's point of view is that we think Asia is a massive opportunity as part of the global stage across which we want to operate. Being part of WP, we're absolutely global and we're absolutely committed to the region. So I think there's a big opportunity. I think it is about scaling in. I think it's about maintaining. People talk about pivoting away from China. I don't agree with that. China's absolutely critical. We'll absolutely remain focused on China. But it is about recognizing the changing nature, the increased maturity of other markets around the region that are going to be incredibly significant in just a few years. I would put out for an example, Indonesia. Already a massive economy, going to be so much bigger, rate of growth that's incredible, rate of capability development that's absolutely remarkable, and one of our biggest and absolute best offices. So I think diversifying our presence here in Asia Pacific and expanding it is certainly going to be part of the plan.
Is there a philosophical issue at all? And by that, I mean, we were on stage last year, you and me, and I think in Singapore, Lauren Myers-Kavanagh as well from Microsoft. And we were talking about whether Asian companies will become more activist in the style that we have seen in the West. And I wonder whether that will happen. And I wonder if it needs to happen for the industry to hear to realize its ambitions, or is there a different avenue that can still unlock perhaps the levels of spending that we see on public relations in other parts of the world? So that's kind of a multi-part question, but I know you have some interesting views on brand activism, particularly as it relates to Asian companies.
It's a really good question. So I'll tackle it starting off with that activism point, because it is interesting. And as you rightly say, it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. So sorry if I bang on about this too much, you can edit me out. There's a great Drucker quote on the challenge of times of turbulence isn't the turbulence itself, but acting with yesterday's logic. It might be yesterday's logic to ask the question, are Asian brands going to become activists in the way that Western are? I don't think so, no. I think the model is different. The context is different. But will they demonstrate a different type of voice? And will that voice carry on to a regional and global scale? Good question. There's a lot of challenges with that. As we discussed on stage, there is, I think, perhaps more reticence. When I look at our client base across Asia Pacific, if you're a multinational company operating in Asia Pacific, you do have limitations in that you are managing not just your reputation on this side of the world, but you're managing a global reputation. So what you say over here does impact European and US audiences. And therefore, if you're talking about D&I, sustainability, or political issues that brands might want to be activist on, then you're going to have to bear those sensitivities in mind. Then for locally based international companies, it's just a very different perspective on those issues. And the narrative that exists currently is an old narrative, an outdated narrative that is about often China versus US, or often just about what's happening in the Americas or Europe. So I think the pre-existing narrative doesn't fit for those companies. And so they haven't yet found necessarily a voice of what issues they might want to campaign on, or what the benefits might be, or how it fits into their reputation globally. So I also think cost has been an impact globally and in Asia Pacific. I think where you are feeling cost conscious about your marketing budget, you also probably necessarily become a little bit more risk conscious. Perhaps you focus more on brand, more on more reliable ROI drivers in the marketing mix rather than activism, which we know will work and get attention, but might be harder to link back to commercial goals. The controversy has certainly led to, I think, a slightly increased level of conservatism within a lot of companies in terms of the risk it takes. So, yes, there's headwinds, but there's a massive opportunity. And this is my kind of hobby horse. I think that sustainability on the human side, be it DEI or on the environmental side and everything in between, needs to remain part of the popular agenda. I mean, on this side of the world, certainly in Thailand where I'm sitting, large parts of this side of the world are going to be underwater unless we solve, you know, sustainability issues. It has a material impact here that's very, very real. And also, of course, we're the root cause of a lot of the issues that are discussed, in that we source a lot of the agricultural products like palm oil that might be at the center of debates. We create and burn a lot of the energy that's being used. We're, we're responsible for a great deal of the shipping. So we are both central to a cause of it, but also directly impacted. And so it's really important to us on this side of the world that the dialogue doesn't just stop or get drowned out in culture wars. Likewise, on DEI, the dialogue has been too Western driven. It's not been appropriate for this side of the world. And so it hasn't really helped drive change here, if change is needed, in that it's been not particularly relevant to the demographics, religions, politics, cultural norms of this side of the world. So all that said, I think there's an opportunity for it to be reinvented, but reinvented age first. I would love to see, and I'm talking to companies, to see how we can take the topic of sustainability and rewrite that narrative, reform the lexicon in a new way, and design it in an Asia first way that can then go global. It's a bold ambition. Will it happen? I don't know. But I do think there's a space for it. I'd love to see it.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that the going global thing, because that's crucial here as well, right? So many of these Asian companies now are, you know, increasingly expansionary, and not necessarily in terms of looking at the US and Europe, but, you know, in terms of Africa, Latin America, Middle East, Southeast Asia, we see so much expansion now. You talked about sustainability and how important that is. You've just come out with a report, Decoding Sustainability. Is that what
Decoding Sustainability, yes. Authored by a combination of our amazing digital team, our fantastic AI tool portfolio that did all the legwork, and then our head of sustainability, Michael Rydick. And it's just a really interesting look at the language that people are using around sustainability and whether it engages. Mm-hmm. So we have these brilliant AI tools that can measure believability and virality of different words, different phrases, different spokespeople, different sources, and it can really program in at a very tactical and minute detail level how you can get more or less engagement with different audiences by using different words, different phrases, different images, different channels. And so we use that tool to analyze conversations around sustainability and work out where are the gaps between what people want to be hearing and what they're interested in and what a company's saying. And we looked at that in three markets across the region and some of the differences. And it's fascinating stuff. I mean, obviously, some of the findings are very, in some ways, predictable. You know, the sustainability across the region is still incredibly heavily linked in people's minds to UN development goals. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, you could argue the toss, and there's probably various different shades of that depending on your particular requirements and your position at looking at that. But it's interesting that, again, there isn't a sort of locally driven narrative around sustainability, that people's association goes straight to the United Nations and their goals. But I think this tool in itself is, it's not just for sustainability. It can be for any type of communications. And the interesting thing we've seen in response from clients is, it's just an immediate, oh, can you, you know, can I feed some of my materials, my press materials, my website into that? And can it tell me how to rewrite it in a way that's more engaging? And it's fascinating how that tool can be used, not just with sustainability, but with so many other aspects of driving reputation for business, provide more predictable results, more measurable results.
Burson has been investing a fair amount in its tools. I think it's safe to say. It was about a month ago, or maybe a bit longer, that the agency's Reputation Capital platform came out, which I think is a pretty significant undertaking for Burson in its attempts to, I suppose, quantify reputation. So tell us what the possibilities are with this platform, and whether you see any kind of pitfalls in terms of realizing them.
Yeah, I mean, as a communications professional, we bandy around terms like game changing and industry defining far too often. I honestly feel everyone like this is one of those. I mean, it is. It is a game changer. I remember sitting around at Helen Alton 25 or so years ago with an amazing guy, one of my former mentors, Tony Burgess Webb, working on various platforms that he was creating at that point to try and link communications to share price. And they came up with some really, really good models. When you look at that versus RepCap, it's like kind of comparing my first Nokia to my iPhone. It's barely even in the same category. And so this is a challenge we've been talking about in our industry well before I joined this industry and before you did, right? This has been a perennial challenge of we can't measure the effect of PR. We know it's working, but we can't tangibly measure it. You know, that old adage of I know half of my marketing budget is working, I just don't know which half. So, you know, this is going to solve that. This is going to be something that is actually going to be able to put metrics against reputation. And therefore, by defining the value of it, it's just going to lift that function within every business, I think. I think it's going to put us on much better integration level with the rest of the marketing mix that already have a decent measurement tools. But I think it's going to have a variety of different effects as well. So the tool itself will allow businesses to look at 8 different factors which can be well-tailored, which drive reputation and can take an enormous amount of data to link that into share price, to sales, and ultimately to provide a value for your reputation. But then it can also look at scenarios of, well, what if we did this? If we did this campaign and build it this way, what would then happen? And it can predict the impact. So you can then start saying, okay, well, this is the way we should do this campaign. It's almost like A-B testing in a sandbox to be able to say, right, let's try this or let's try that. But let's go back to the question you asked about brand activism a second ago. If you're a company and you're thinking, well, maybe I want to talk about immigration because immigration is material to my business and I need to be able to discuss it. Let's say, for instance, your Western Union or something like that. You might be thinking, well, I just don't want to touch immigration right now because it's way too dangerous. If you've got a tool like RepCap, you can quantify that risk. That's a huge game changer. Imagine the debate that happens in the C-suite where you've got the CEO talking to comms, marketing, legal. That debate is so often shut down when you get to risk, because if you can't quantify the risk, but the legal side absolutely can, then obviously the CEO's decision is going to go with a quantifiable metric, right? If we're able to say, look, we can do it this way, and we know it'll have these downsides, but these are the measurable downsides, and here are the measurable upsides, then that changes that decision-making process. And maybe that will allow companies to be able to make bolder, different decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, certainly the possibilities look huge. Do you worry at all that it might be too late? One thing I'm noticing also over the last 12 to 18 months is just the level of change in terms of comms functions on the in-house side.
Right.
You know, we're seeing them not just reduce in size, but in some cases dispersing. And, you know, this idea that comms is not even, doesn't even require a separate function sometimes and can just be kind of integrated perhaps into marketing or legal or finance for IR. And that is something that I'm starting to notice is also becoming more acceptable. Now, of course, a tool like this, which can hopefully help demonstrate the value of comms is incredibly helpful, because it, you know, I think the classic challenge has always been, how does the comms function demonstrate that it's driving value rather than just costing dollars? How do you think there is kind of urgency around this as a challenge?
Yeah, I do. I do think there's urgency around it as a challenge. I mean, I think your point on changes to in-house comms teams, I haven't seen that much of that, and I couldn't comment because I don't know. I would guess, by the way, again, see previous comments about economic environment as much as anything else.
Sure.
I think, look, the pitfall with this, if there is one, it in some ways runs counter to that, which is this tool is useless without human beings, right? I mean, we've not created a Ozempic here. We're not giving you an injection and suddenly you're just thin. We've created a gym that you're going to have to go and use to develop some absolutely awesome consultancy muscles, right? All of our people are going to have to get very, very good at using this tool and advising clients on how to use it so that they can make the most of it. It's an incredible tool, but in and of itself, it's useless. It needs human beings in order to get the right information into it, draw the right insights out of it, and then come up with the right ways of changing the communication strategy, developing campaigns, to actually realize the value. So while the machine can tell you the value, if you want to actually realize reputation capital, you're going to need human beings. So I think, you know, this doesn't replace humans, is what I'm saying. It needs humans. Now, the other point I would say is, when we come up with these efficiency tools, yes, it's an efficiency tool, but it's in some ways a post hoc ergo propter hoc argument to think that, well, that's going to need fewer people. What we often see with these efficiency tools is it just massively increases volume. So let's say, for instance, you're a project manager. Project management has just become lots easier with AI, not necessarily RedCap. Our other AI tools, we can automate how you take your meeting notes, how you manage your reporting schedule. So much of that can be automated. Does that mean that that one person is going to be doing a lot less account management, or does it mean that they're able to now account manage five different clients? Right. I mean, when we got email, we didn't all suddenly start going to the pub for 3 days while we're waiting for the return letter that we would have. Right. We suddenly got a lot busier, a hell of a lot busier because volume increases. So I wonder whether with the sophistication of these tools that we're creating, we're actually going to create a lot more possibilities that are therefore going to create a lot more work. That's probably going to take time, and that will still have to be managed against the context of an economic backdrop, because people aren't suddenly just going to be hiring people because we've got a new AI tool. So I think it's going to be a gradual process, but I would not see a pitfall of this being that it erodes jobs. If anything, it's going to create work.
Yeah. It sounds like fun, though, doing more work with less resources. That's always...
This is honestly the cool bit. I mean, I think the time that this frees up that would have been going to the more repetitive, menial, but very important parts of our job, that brain space now goes towards creative thinking, to relationship building, to ideation, to actually client relationship management. So, you know, it frees up this incredibly valuable time. You can't help wondering whether it's... interestingly, you look back in the history of human beings, and it was around about the time when we got good at agriculture that we started getting good at art and philosophy and writing and things like that. You know, the same sort of principle applies. All of this time to be left sort of unbillable or unused, we're going to fill it with new and exciting ways of doing things.
Yeah, we just need the, as you say, the economic backdrop to improve. I think that is such a crucial factor. But actually, it brings us nicely to the final question. You know, we've talked about tools. We've talked about the value of PR networks. And we talked just then about the impact of AI. What are the skills you're looking for from the next generation of PR professionals?
Such a good question. Because it is very hard to predict, because things are moving so fast, even today's logic doesn't necessarily apply to what we might need a year from now. So I'll answer it, I guess, with four capabilities. And then I think perhaps something else on characteristics, which sounds weird, but I think is increasingly important. On capabilities, I refer to another of my mentors and favorite people from years past, which is Bob Grove. Bob Grove used to run incredible training for entering staff who came into the business at Edelman, and would talk about the core PR skills. And these are PR skills that I don't think have changed a great deal in decades. And the four skills that we would train people on were reading and writing persuasively, building effective relationships, efficiently managing multiple workflows, and being able to turn large amounts of information into insights. Right? So four big buckets of capabilities. So how are those going to change? Writing and speaking persuasively. This is a really interesting one. Writing persuasively, I mean, AI does write fairly persuasively. However, once everybody starts using AI to write persuasively, you're going to have a very commoditized bar. And so the skill set to really write well, to write brilliantly, to write like someone trained to write like you, that's going to become, I think, much more of a skill base. You know, there is a scenario here where 20 years from now, we all have 20 years, that's ridiculous. 5 years from now, we all have the same sort of AI platforms. And what will differentiate us will be the humans using those platforms. And that means that some of those core skills on reading and writing persuasively are going to be very important. So I encourage all of our teams, you know, yes, if you wish to do the first draft of your press release on ChatGPT, fine. I prefer you do it by hand and then use ChatGPT for the editing. But I think that core capability of being able to put words together effectively is really, really important. And on speech, effectively, I think we are going to see a lot more of AI being used in spoken communications as well, oral communications. Our next staff meeting that we've got coming up will be presented by my avatar, created by AI, just for a bit of fun. So, you know, we will be seeing that come in, and it's fascinating what AI is going to be able to do in terms of translating languages as well. That ability to communicate effectively human to human, spoken language is going to be increasingly important. Building effective relationships, I don't think AI can help enormously with that yet. And so that's going to become more of a valued skill, I think. You get into project management. Yeah, project management's going to change because that does become significantly different and easier. But I think that might then become, as I said a second ago, about a volume game.
Yeah.
The ability to project manage on a platform when you've got just a massive amount more volume of stuff to be project managed still requires a great project manager. So I think that remain, but be very different. Mm-hmm. And then the ability to turn research into insight, I think, will remain incredibly important, but it's going to be a slightly different skill. I actually think in many ways we're going to have to dual run the ability for humans to do this as well as AI. For AI to take lots of information and give you an insight out of it, that's incredibly useful, but just trusting that might not be the best way. We might need to have a parallel human process. We certainly need an editing process to check back on it. So I think our ability to turn research into insights, again, will probably be affected by volume. There'll be a much greater volume of the people that have that skill. They'll be doing much more of it, and it'll be much faster. But I still think there's going to be a much greater need now for humans to be able to test those insights, to be able to really know whether they are the right insight for the client. So I think the capabilities are going to shift a bit, but ultimately it's still going to be about trying to affect what people think, feel, and do through communications and third-party endorsement. So there'll be big changes. The characteristics that we'll be looking for will be increasingly a little bit different, though. I think adaptability and agility are increasingly important. At the same time, I think specialism is increasingly important as well. I wonder whether, you know, my career path that I described to you a bit ago, I wonder how rare that will be 5 years from now. Probably quite rare.
Being a generalist, less common. Less common, for sure.
Certainly less common, right? So I think specialization and the interest in being specialized is certainly a characteristic we'd probably be looking at more. But I think the element of curiosity is vital. If you imagine the context our companies are operating in, reputation, culture, and policy are now intertwined in every decision they're having to make.
Yes.
And communication is no longer about what they do, what they say, it's about what they do. So if you're advising companies not just on their communication, but on their actions, and you're having to do it with a view through reputation, culture, and policy, you have to have broad awareness of a lot of things and the ability to quickly put together a lot of different bits of information. That requires curiosity. It requires you to want to know a lot of stuff in a broad range around whatever field you're working in. So I think intellectual curiosity is going to be absolutely critical. It is something we're really very good on in our industry, I think, but we're probably going to have to really step up on that.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when people ask me this kind of question, I always say curiosity is still the most important thing. And it's not something you can commoditize,
I don't think. No, and I don't think you can easily encourage or even inculcate it. I think people come to you, you might be able to inspire it in people a bit, but it is something that people demonstrate the capacity for or perhaps don't. And so it's something we'll be looking for. Yes, we'll try and find out ways to train people and to inspire people into developing that skill, but it is something that we'll have to look for at interview stage, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, Adrian, thank you so much for your time. This has been such a fun chat.
It's always fun chatting with you, Arun. I really appreciate you having me on. I appreciate you giving me the time. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. You take care. Hopefully we'll get you back on the podcast in the not too distant future. And no doubt I'll see you soon. Thank you.
Anytime, my friend. Look forward to seeing you.